headlines. The Syrian foreign minister arrives in Saudi Arabia on the first such trip since the breakout of the foreign-backed militancy in Syria in 2011. Iran's foreign ministry says an Iranian delegation is in Saudi Arabia to prepare for the reopening of the embassy and consulate in the kingdom. And the Greek Orthodox Church slams Israel for enforcing what it calls unreasonable actions on its upcoming Easter celebrations in the occupied Al-Quds. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Syrian foreign minister has arrived in Saudi Arabia amid the ongoing rapprochement efforts between the two Arab states. Faisal Miqdad made the trip at the invitation of his Saudi counterpart, Faisal bin Farhan. This is the first such trip by Syrian foreign minister to Saudi Arabia since the breakout of the foreign-backed militancy in Syria in 2011. In the meantime, Syria says that it will reopen its diplomatic mission in Tunisia and appoint an ambassador there following a similar decision by Tunis. Also, nine Arab countries are set to hold a summit in Saudi Arabia later this week to discuss Syria's return to the Arab League. Let's get an update on the story from Mohammed Ali, our correspondent, who joins us from Damascus. Well, obviously, this is a very significant trip that has been made. Tell us more about the ongoings and what we may expect out of this, and, of course, any information you have on this.
Yes, according to Syrian state media, Syria's foreign minister, Faisal al-Maqdad, arrived in the Saudi city of Jeddah, accompanied by assistant Syrian foreign minister, Ayman Susan. The Syrian official delegation was welcomed by Saudi Arabia's deputy foreign minister and a number of other Saudi officials. According to Syrian state media, and I quote, the foreign minister will be discussing with the Saudi side bilateral relations with the brotherly country and topics of mutual interest. Now, this is according to Syrian state media. On the other hand, the Saudi state media, the Saudi press agency, confirmed the news. Of course, it clarified that the visit of Syria's foreign minister comes following an invitation by his Saudi counterpart, Faisal bin Farhan. Also, according to Saudi media, the officials from both countries will be discussing the efforts exerted for reaching a political solution for Syria's crisis in a way that preserves Syria's unity, stability, and security. Topics will also cover the facilitations for the return of Syrian refugees back to Syria, as well as efforts made for sending more humanitarian aid to the Syrians affected in areas that was hit by the recent earthquakes. Now, definitely this is the most significant development in the relations between both countries since Saudi Arabia severed ties, closed its embassies almost a decade ago. It's very important to point out that such a step, such a visit that we're seeing right now has been only possible due to several factors. One of them is the agreement that was reached between perhaps Iran and Saudi Arabia on restoring diplomatic ties. And we all remember what Iran said at that time and even previously, that dialogue among countries of the region is the only solution for solving the problems of this region without any kind of foreign intervention. So definitely this is a significant development happening in the region.
If you have information, Mohammed Ali, about this meeting that's going to be held in Saudi Arabia that we have in our news regarding how there's going to be nine Arab countries that will be meeting later this week to discuss Syria's return to the Arab League. Do you have any information on that? Because that appears to be, obviously, it would set the tone for many Arab countries to have Syria come back into the fold.
Exactly. Been seeing lots of efforts exerted by several sides in the region for Syria's return to the Arab League, perhaps. However, we also have to point out to what Syrian president said before, that the matter is not about Syria's return to the Arab League. What is more important than that is restoring normal relations, bilateral relations among countries of this region. This is much more important than Syria's return to the Arab League or attending the Arab League summit. We don't have information on that upcoming meeting, but it's clear, looking at the developments, that most of the countries of the region do want to restore relations back with Syria. It seems that they have realized that cutting ties, adopting the hostile stances will never solve any kind of problems in the region, and dialogue is the only solution. Those countries have now realized that fact, and this is what we're seeing now, efforts exerted to restore relations with Syria. It's highly possible to see Syria attending the upcoming Arab League summit in May. We have to wait and see at the end of the day what will happen in those talks. I think there are only a couple of countries that are still opposing Syria's return to the Arab League, and the efforts being exerted in the region, whether by Iran, now Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, will perhaps be fruitful, will be positive efforts in bringing back Syria to the Arab League and bringing good relations between Syria and all Arab countries in this region.
Thank you very much for that. Mohammed Ali there from Damascus. Thank you, Mohammed. Well, Iran has sent a delegation to Saudi Arabia to prepare for the reopening of the country's diplomatic missions in the kingdom. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said the delegation has already been received in Riyadh. Nasser Kanani said the group will make necessary arrangements for opening Iran's embassy in the Saudi capital, as well as a consulate in the port city of Jeddah. The activities of Iran's representative office in the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation will also be discussed. Iran and Saudi Arabia announced the restoration of their diplomatic ties under a China-brokered reconciliation deal in March. The two West Asian countries severed ties in 2016 following some untoward incidents. Iran has halted visits by non-Muslims, including Jews, to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound until the end of the month of Ramadan. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made the announcement after a wave of unrest and condemnations over the regime's brutal attacks on Muslim worshippers at Islam's third holiest site. According to Palestine Information Center, Israeli forces have also been ordered to stop settlers from visiting the Al-Aqsa compound from Wednesday. Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has described Netanyahu's decision as a blatant mistake. Ben-Gvir has been on the forefront of supporting terrorism and incitement against Palestinians. The resistance movement Hamas has called on Palestinians to mobilize and to gather at Al-Aqsa during the last 10 days of Ramadan. According to a 1967 agreement, non-Muslims are allowed onto the site during visiting hours, but they are barred from any religious rituals there.
Reacting to a threat-riddled speech by the Israeli Prime Minister, Hamas resistance movement said Benjamin Netanyahu's remarks will not weaken Palestinians' resolve to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque against the occupying regime's aggression.
Netanyahu's speech cannot frighten our Palestinian people. Palestinians will continue the battle to defend the identity of Al-Aqsa Mosque in the face of the religious war waged by the enemy.
Qassem's remarks came as the Tel Aviv regime has been dangerously stoking tensions throughout the occupied territories and beyond when it carried out a savage attack on Palestinian worshippers who were observing the holy fasting month of Ramadan at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, which is Islam's third holiest site. The first bout of the raid saw the regime's forces storming the compound, beating the Palestinian worshippers there before arresting and forcing out hundreds of them. Dozens of Palestinians were wounded as a result of the violence. The raids prompted several rounds of retaliatory rocket strikes against the occupied territories from the direction of the Gaza Strip, where Hamas is headquartered, as well as from Lebanon and Syria. During his Monday speech, Netanyahu admitted that the regime has responded to retaliatory strikes by dropping 50 tons of bombs on ground targets belonging to Hamas in the Gaza Strip. He also accused Hamas of being behind the reprisal attacks that targeted the occupied territories from Lebanon, saying, "We will not allow Hamas to establish itself in Lebanon by acting on all fronts." The Israeli premier also claimed that the regime had thwarted hundreds of operations in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year, alleging that the regime could reach the resistance everywhere. Responding to Netanyahu's claims, Qassem described his speech as an attempt to falsify the facts, saying that the Israeli occupation was the basis of all tensions across the occupied territories. The Hamas official said the occupiers are the ones who practice terrorism systematically and continuously, pointing out that the Palestinian people are waging a legitimate battle to restore their right to freedom and independence. He added that Netanyahu's threats against our Palestinian people, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran prove that the occupying regime is a menace to the entire region and its interests.
Tensions are running high across the occupied territories. Israeli forces and settlers have been carrying out raids at Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Al-Quds, while Palestinians have been retaliating with rocket attacks from Gaza, as well as shooting and car ramming operations. Latest polls show support for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right coalition cabinet to have plummeted in recent weeks.
The Israeli army was taken aback by the allegations of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who said on April 10th that attacks on Lebanon last week targeted Hezbollah positions. The Israeli premier said during a news conference on Monday that in the attacks on Lebanon, in addition to the positions of Hamas, we also targeted the positions of Hezbollah in Lebanon. According to Yossi Yehoshua, the military affairs commentator for an Israeli daily, the army was very surprised to hear Netanyahu say that Hezbollah's infrastructure was attacked in Lebanon, as Tel Aviv took great care to only hit alleged Hamas targets. Netanyahu's sham allegation came during a press conference in which he also backpedaled on his decision to sack his minister Yoav Gallant. The embattled premier said, "I've decided to put our differences behind us." Earlier in his speech, Netanyahu took aim at the opposition led by former Prime Minister Yair Lapid, blaming him for the multiple crises gripping Israel. Netanyahu accused Lapid and his officials of showing weakness. In particular, the premier pointed to the maritime demarcation deal signed with the Lebanese government last year under U.S. mediation, claiming the agreement had been signed with Hezbollah without getting anything in return. Netanyahu also blasted Israeli citizens and army reservists who took to the streets to protest against his judicial overhaul plan, saying, "When you declare that Israel is collapsing, how do you think our enemies interpret this?" Monday's speech came just hours after Israeli media released poll results showing that support for Netanyahu's Likud party has nosedived. According to the survey, more than two-thirds of voters disapproved of Netanyahu's performance in office. If elections were held today, Likud would lose more than a third of its seats in the Knesset.
The Greek Orthodox Church decries Israel for enforcing what it calls unreasonable restrictions on its upcoming Easter celebrations in the occupied Al-Quds. Comes as talks between church leaders and the Israeli regime on attendance numbers at the Holy Fire ceremony on Saturday have failed. Response: Father Mateos Siopis from the Greek Orthodox Church urged Christians to attend in defiance of the Israeli heavy-handed curbs. He also vowed that churches will freely worship and do so in peace. Last year, Israeli forces imposed barriers throughout the Christian quarter of Al-Quds, sparking clashes with worshippers. The Palestinian Committee for Al-Quds has launched a social media campaign commemorating Al-Quds Day in the besieged Gaza Strip. Ola Al-Assi reports from Gaza.
Hundreds of Palestinian social media activists took part in a ceremony organized by the Palestinian Committee for Al-Quds to commemorate the Al-Quds Day in Gaza. The activists mainly used the hashtag "The West Bank is Al-Quds Shield" on Twitter, which is a banner of this year's event.
This reflects the growing resistance in towns, villages, and camps of the West Bank, which constitute a shield for Gaza amid the Israeli occupation's threats of erasing its civilization's heritage. This also reflects the unity of the Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza, Diaspora, and Al-Quds.
In this campaign, the Palestinians follow what they call media confrontation, through which they share posts and tweets about the Israeli regime's violations against the Palestinian people in the occupied Palestinian territories, especially amidst the recent escalations in Al-Quds.
Palestinian youth commemorate the God's Day by exposing the Israeli occupation's policies and atrocities to international public opinion and holding Israel accountable for these crimes. As the Israeli regime commits crimes with impunity, and sometimes international organizations are complicit in these crimes.
This tweeting comes in response to the social network's targeting of the Palestinian content to suppress the Palestinian narrative, especially amid any Israeli aggression, when Palestinians utilize the online means to expose the Israeli atrocities.
The Palestinian content, especially in the past few years, is suppressed on social media platforms, and the Palestinian narrative is restricted. We as social media specialists and activists are trying to understand the platform's bias algorithms to help publish Palestinian content and expose Israeli crimes.
The national and Islamic factions, as well as the resistance forces, stressed on the unity of Palestine, as well as the axis of resistance, saying that the axis is more coherent and integrated today than before, and it's confronting the Tel Aviv's regime with all its might.
Our people, along with the resistance, axis, and Islamic nation, yearn together in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa. This can be achieved by broadening the fronts of the resisting the Israeli occupation using all means. The Arab, the Islamic countries need to follow in the footsteps of the Islamic Republic in supporting the Palestinian cause, people, and resistance to liberate the Holy Mosque.
This annual event comes in Ramadan every year and continues for the sixth consecutive year in Gaza, where Palestinians, along with the Arab world, reiterate their support for the Palestinian people in their struggle against Israeli occupation and for Al-Quds.
Palestinian activists are using every means available in order to refute the Israeli occupation's propaganda campaign, especially amid the current wave of intensified Israeli aggression. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Just stay with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Confederation of National Health Service of England has warned about the consequences of crippling strike by junior doctors and the cancellation of tens of thousands of medical appointments in the midst of the country's healthcare crisis. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The National Health Service Confederation has said up to a quarter of a million medical appointments and operations could be postponed because of 4 days of strikes in the coming days by junior doctors in England. Dr. Leila McKay, the Director of Policy at the Confederation, which represents Health Trust, said National Health Service bosses were more concerned about the impact of the later strike than any other that had taken place so far. Junior medics in England will take industrial action after the Easter bank holiday weekend from on Tuesday, 11th of April, until 6:59 a.m. local time on Saturday, 15th of April. The British Medical Association, BMA, the UK's trade union for doctors and medical students, said the strikes could still be avoided if the government made a credible pay offer. Dr. Leila McKay told BBC Radio 4's Today programme, "In the last junior doctor strike, we saw about 175,000 appointments and operations having to be postponed. In terms of the disruption that we're anticipating this time, we reckon it could be up to about a quarter of a million. So that is a huge amount of impact for patients up and down the country." She added, "What we're hearing from our members who are health leaders across the whole system is that they're more concerned about this than they have been about any other strike. They think that the impact is going to be significant, that this one is likely to have impact on patient safety, and that is a huge concern for every healthcare leader." Dr. Mike Greenall, a deputy chair of the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee, told BBC One's Breakfast, "It's hard to negotiate when only one side is doing it, and we're not getting anything back from the government." Dr. Mike Greenall added, "We're happy to meet at any time. We would still meet him over the bank holiday weekend before the industrial action next week. And if he was to bring a credible offer to us, it could still, even at this late stage, avert action." The Department of Health and Social Care has insisted the British Medical Association has to call off the strike for any negotiations to take place. The British Medical Association has called on Steve Barclay to negotiate to resolve what it calls 15 years of pay erosion, with junior doctors losing more than 26% of their pay in real terms. Dr. Mike Greenhall said, "At the moment, we have over 7 million people on waiting lists, and the way we can get that down is making sure the National Health Service is properly funded and properly staffed." Sky News has also covered this story and tells us more. Stephen Powis, National Medical Director for NHS England, said in a statement, "We're very concerned about the potential severity of impact on patients and services across the country," highlighting that hospitals face almost 100 hours without as little as half of the NHS medical workforce. The strike comes at a particularly busy time for the National Health Service, with demand for services expected to be high after the Easter bank holiday weekend, and many other NHS staff on annual leave during the school holidays. Dr. Leila McKay said the disruption could last up to 10 or 11 days, with the strike running between the Easter bank holiday and another weekend. She said the impact is going to be so significant that this one is likely to have impact on patient safety, and that is a huge concern for every healthcare leader. Hospital bosses have said they cannot guarantee patients will be safe as managers struggle to arrange staffing during the strike, which will affect both emergency and planned care. The British Medical Association, BMA, has also announced that it will not exempt any services, but that there are plans to protect patients, which could involve pulling junior doctors off the picket line if individual hospitals report lives are in immediate danger. Dr. Mike Greenall, a deputy chair of the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee, has apologised to patients who had their operations or appointments cancelled, and he insisted patient safety would not be put at risk. Dr. Mike Greenhall claimed patient safety was maintained at the last strikes and it will be also in this strike. Britain's Health Secretary Steve Barclay had been urged to meet union representatives in an attempt to resolve the issue, but the negotiations remained deadlocked last night since the minister insisted the British Medical Association has to call off the strike for any negotiations to take place. Britain's Health Secretary Steve Barclay wrote in The Telegraph, "It is deeply disappointing that this industrial action has been timed by the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee to cause maximum disruption to both patients and other NHS staff. The junior doctors insist it is up to the Health Secretary to make them a credible offer." Dr. Vivek Trivedi and Dr. Rob Lawrenson, the co-chairs of the British Medical Association Junior Doctors Committee, said the strikes could still be avoided if the government made a credible pay offer. Junior doctors are asking for a 35% pay rise to reverse the steep decline they have faced after years of below-inflation pay rises. The British Medical Association says that since 2008-2009, they have had a real-term pay cut of 26%, and they're now seeking full pay restoration. They also want to agree on a mechanism to prevent future declines in their pay and to reform the pay review process. The strike would be the latest in a wave of disruptive labour actions by public sector workers in the United Kingdom demanding pay hikes to offset inflation that exceeds 10%. Passport office staff were on strike last week. Civil servants plan to strike on 28th of April, and the UK's biggest teaching union, the National Education Union, is preparing for five more days of walkouts. A cost-of-living crisis driven by sharp food and energy price increases has left the British people struggling to pay their bills, as union wages have fallen in real terms over the past decade. Almost a quarter of British adults are in a worse financial position in 2023 during the cost-of-living crisis, while the number of those struggling to pay back their loans has increased by half since last year. This is according to the second annual financial inclusion report, now published by ethical lender Plend. The FinTech Times said the report focuses on the impact of the cost-of-living crisis, personal and household finances, and the resultant impacts on access to financial services in the United Kingdom. The findings emphasize how badly some groups, including young people and ethnic minorities, have been affected more by the cost of living crisis than by the coronavirus pandemic.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
We offer our condolences to each and every one of you, as well as to the Imam of our time, Imam Al-Mahdi, as we mark the tragic martyrdom anniversary, the beginning of the tragic martyrdom anniversary of the Commander of the Faithful, the Prince of the Believers, Asadullah al-Ghalib, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wassalam. He said, I want to tonight look at Amir al-Mu'mineen as a multidimensional man. You know, and tonight I want to focus primarily on him as being a family man, as being a husband, as being a father. You know, this is, you know, not just something that somebody does. No, this is something that a person has to live. But who is Imam Ali? You know, we use his name so often. We name our children Ali. We try and make it a point to go to Najaf, to his holy shrine, to pay our respects to him, to greet him, to be in the company of the soul of the commander of the faithful. But how much do we know about the Imam? You know, as I said, that yes, he's a father, he became a husband, he is the soul of the Prophet, he's all of these accolades, but at the core of it, he's a human being just like us. Obviously, he's like us in his humanity, but he's not like us in the maqamat that he has, the stations that Allah has given to him. But as we know, brothers and sisters, in the 4 years and some months of the Khilafat of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he had to fight major battles. He had to fight Jamal against Aisha, the wife of the Prophet, where thousands of Muslims were killed. He had to fight in Siffin against Muawiyah, who was claiming to be the successor of the Prophet, in which thousands of Muslims were killed because of those political advances of the leader of Sham. And he had to fight in Nahrawan against the Khawarij, who had left Islam because of their twisted interpretation of Islam. And so it was in the month actually of Ramadan, brothers and sisters, a year before the Shahadat of Imam Ali, that people began to congregate in Masjid al-Haram in Mecca. And they all had grudges against different people of the Ummah, but all of them had a hatred for one man, and that was Imam Ali alayhi salam. And on those nights in Masjid al-Haram, in the month of Ramadan, before the year before the martyrdom of Imam Ali, some people got together to plan and to kill certain individuals. There was one man in this group of the Khawarij who said, "We have a problem with the governor in Egypt who was appointed by Muawiyah, so I'm going to go and kill him." And the plan was hatched. Another man plotted that, you know what, Muawiyah is the problem with this ummah, let's kill Muawiyah and we'll do away with all of the fitna in the ummah. So a second man or the three would plan to go and kill Muawiyah. And then the third man is the one that we remember tonight, Amir al-Mu'mineen, because in that group of people in Mecca, one of them named Abdurrahman ibn Muljim, la'natullah alayh, his plan was he would go to Kufa and kill Amir al-Mu'mineen. They all had this twisted Khawarij mentality that kill the people, kill these individuals, and you'll bring about reformation in Islam. Historians say that the one who went to Egypt to kill Amr al-As, he was not successful. The one who went to kill Muawiyah and Sham, he was also not successful. But that third man, Ibn Muljim, la'natullah alayh, we know that when he got to Kufa months before the month of Ramadan, he began to plan and plot. He met a woman that he saw one day in the streets of Kufa, and he fell in love with this woman. Rather, he fell in lust with this woman. He didn't know what love was. He wanted to marry her, and he went to her and he says, "I want to marry you. What is your mahar? What will I have to give to you to marry you?" She said, "I want 10,000 dirham. I want X amount of slaves, and I want the head of Ali ibn Abi Talib. I want Ali's head served to me on a platter. Why do you want him dead?" And she said that he killed my brother and my father in the Battle of Nahrawan. She was one of the Khawarij. Her family had left Islam. They were munafiqs of the worst degree. And so Abdurrahman says, "How can I kill Ali? He's the lion of Allah, Asadullah al-Ghalib. He can't be defeated on battlefield. What do you want me to do to kill him?" And that's where she told him that, you know, you can't kill him on the battlefield, but you can kill him in the mihrab. Because when it comes to namaz, he has such a connection to Allah, everything else is gone. He can't think or hear or see anything around him. It's only Allah when it comes to the time of namaz. And so the plan was hatched, the poison was ordered, the swords were ready. And it was on that morning of the 19th, brothers and sisters, a morning just like this in Masjid al-Kufa, that Imam Ali alayhi salam, after he had finished his iftar at the house of al-Kulthum, his daughter alayhi salam, that he passed half of the night in ibadat. He had eaten very little on that iftar that night. And in the time before the Fajr Adhan, he makes his way from his house near Masjid al-Kufa, and he walks in slow, deliberate steps towards Masjid al-Kufa. Normally the Muadhin will give the Adhan, but on that morning, brothers and sisters, the streets of Kufa would be filled with the voice of Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he would climb to the roof of Masjid al-Kufa and he would proclaim Allah's greatness by saying, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. He would say, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Historians say the city of Kufa reverberated with the voice of Mawla Ali. They say that every house heard the voice of Imam Ali. There were no speakers in that time, no microphones, but his voice was amplified into every home. This was the last day, brothers and sisters, that people would hear the voice of Mawla Ali. This is the last day that they would see him in the mihrab, because in a few moments that same mihrab of ibadat, that same mihrab of worship would be a mihrab of blood. It would be the mihrab full of the blood of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He comes down from the top of the masjid. He goes into the mihrab. He offers a 2-rakat mustahab namaz. He finishes the mustahab namaz. He begins the iqama for the jamaat namaz of the fajr. He begins with the fajr prayer. The people have gathered behind him. He knows that Abdul Rahman ibn Muljim is in the audience. He's seen him once as he came into the masjid. As Amir al-Mu'mineen, brothers and sisters, is in the namaz, he finishes his first rakat. He's in the sajda of the first rakat. He puts his head from the first sajda to come up. He says, Allahu Akbar, astaghfirullah rabbi wa atubu ilay. And this is when the cursor Ibn Muljim runs towards Amir al-Mu'mineen. He has the sword in his hand. He has the poison sword in his hand. He strikes on the head of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the same spot where he had been attacked many years ago in one of the battles. And the historians say that at that point, the head of Amir al-Mu'mineen begins to split open. The blood begins to pour down his head. His white beard is becoming drenched with his blood. His white beard is turning red from the blood. This is where he says, Bismillahi wa billah, wa fi sabilillah, wa ala millati rasulillah, fustu bi rabbil Kaaba. By the Lord of the Kaaba, indeed I am successful. We're told that Imam Hassan and Hussein run towards their father. They begin to cry. They see Imam Hassan and Imam Ali in the state that he is in. Imam Ali moves to the side. Imam Hassan takes his place. Imam Hassan continues the prayers. They finish the Jamaat namaz in the Masjid al-Kufa. One group of people go to chase the cursor Ibn Muljim. Another group of people are around Imam Ali. The news begins to travel throughout the city. The daughters of Imam Ali heard that their father has been attacked. They begin to cry. They begin to moan. Slowly, as they take the body of Imam Ali, as they begin to carry Imam Ali back to his house, as they carry Imam Ali, and they bring him into his house, and they put him on the bed where he will be laying for 2 days until his shahadat. The historians mention one point, I'll end with this, brothers and sisters, that as Imam Ali is on the ground, as the blood is going through, pouring from his head, as the poison is going through his body, he feels a drop fall on him. This is not a drop of blood, this is a drop of tears from Imam Hassan. Imam Hassan is over the body of his father. He's over the body of his dear father, and he's crying because of what he sees. Imam Ali feels the tears of his son, Imam Hassan. He opens his eyes and he says, Ya Hassan. He says, Oh Hassan, my dear son, you're crying for me. Don't cry. I see Rasulullah. I see my Habib right here. I see Umm al-Mu'mineen Khadija right here. I see your mother Fatima Zahra right here. Don't cry, because there will be a day that the same thing will happen to you, that you will be poisoned. And there will be a day when your brother Hussein will also be in the same situation, and he will be killed by the swords on the day of Ashura.
Okay.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
In the limelight.
While Israelis protest against Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir's war on the judiciary, the High Court of the Zionist regime enables the occupying regime's use of torture against Palestinian prisoners. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye noted, before the current far-right government's war on the judiciary, there was a little covered news story out of the Zionist regime's Supreme Court. On December 29, 2022, the Zionist regime's High Court once again capitulated to the demands of the regime regarding the issue of prison conditions and the size of prison cells in particular. It granted the regime's request and extended, for the third time, the deadline for expanding the living space of detainees until December 31, 2027. In response to a petition by Israeli human rights organizations, including the Association for Civil Rights, ACRI, the Supreme Court issued an order in June 2017 to expand the living space of prisoners to 4.5 square meters, giving the Zionist regime's prison service an initial deadline of 9 months. In most Western countries, the size of standard prison cells ranges between 6 and 12 square meters, while in the occupied territories, it is less than 3 square meters. The ruling seemed to acknowledge the cruel, humiliating, and inhuman living conditions of the prisoners. In the opening statement of the decision, Judge Yitzhak Amit wrote that society is evaluated through its treatment of prisoners. He pointed out that depriving them of their freedom through imprisonment does not mean depriving them of their right to dignity, which stems from the prisoner's right to determine the minimum living space. However, despite this statement, the court approved maintaining these conditions for an additional 5 years, which then became 10 years from the initial judgment. In 2014, ACRI, Physicians for Human Rights, PHRI, and other groups petitioned the Zionist regime Supreme Court to address overcrowding in Israeli jails and prisons and compel the regime to immediately increase the living area of prisoners to a minimum 4.5 square meters as a temporary solution until it is raised even further as part of a long-term plan. The petition stated that prisoners are forced to spend hours of their day in bed without the ability to move or stand, and those sharing a cell are unable to stand or walk at the same time in the limited space. As a result, prisoners are often forced to carry out their entire daily routine in bed, including eating. It further argues that overcrowding creates suffocation in the cells, harms the health of the prisoners, and causes increased friction between them. It is far from the acceptable size in countries considered democratic and from the minimum adopted by international institutions to ensure reasonable, adequate living conditions that are mentioned in the 2012 report published by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Unfortunately, the situation in the Zionist regime's prisons has been the same for decades, but the regime has done nothing to offer solutions or make changes. In its 2019 to 2020 annual report, the Zionist regime's public defense warned of prison overcrowding and prisoner rights violations. The report described the existing prison conditions as a serious violation of human dignity. It criticized the narrow size of the prison cell at 2.5 square meters, asserting that it is too small for even one resident. The report reiterated earlier calls to immediately stop holding prisoners in these cells, maintaining that they are unfit for human beings. It further noted that the prison cell area today is less than half of the minimum approved by the Zionist regime's prison service, the main carceral authority, which specified 6 square meters as a reasonable amount of space. The public defense report further held that this matter not only affects the rights of detainees, but also violates the regime's obligation to refrain from cruel, inhumane, and degrading punishment, a basic standard of international law. On June 13, 2017, the Zionist regime Supreme Court ordered the regime to increase the minimum prison living area. To ease the implementation of these reforms, the High Court divided the process into two stages. The first would grant the regime 9 months to increase the living area for prisoners to 3 square meters, not including a toilet and shower. An additional 9 months from the court order to increase the living area further to 4.5 square meters would comprise the second stage. However, on March 5, 2018, a week before the deadline for stage one reforms expired, the regime submitted a request to the court to postpone the implementation for 10 years from the initial ruling to 2027. The regime argued that the compliance with the timeline established by the court would require a mass release of prisoners and endanger the public. The petitioners rejected these claims, arguing that the regime took no action to conduct new detention centers and restating the High Court's observation about the inadequate facilities, many of which were built during the British Mandate. It also opposed the suggestion of a public safety issue, calling these idle threats intended to intimidate the court. The court sharply criticized the regime's actions and initially rejected the regime's request. This compelled the regime to submit a plan to construct new wings for hundreds of security prisoners and an increase of administrative release that will result in the evacuation of about 1,000 places of confinement. In June 2018, the Zionist regime updated the court on its intent to use Saharonim prison in Negev Desert as an immigration detention center as part of the first stage of reform. As for the second stage of the ruling, guaranteeing a minimum living space of 4.5 square meters for each prisoner by December 2018, the regime failed to make any progress on this matter, leading human rights groups to demand that the court force it to adhere to the letter of its judgment. In a notice issued on July 29, 2018, the Zionist regime informed the court of its plan to establish by the year 2026 new centers for housing prisoners interrogated by Shin Bet, the Zionist regime security service. It also announced its intent to petition the High Court to amend its judgment in order to exempt Shin Bet facilities from expanding the living space for prisoners until 2027. Currently, Shin Bet's cell size is 2 square meters or less. The petitioners, representing various human rights groups, opposed the regime's request, arguing that this population should actually receive priority in the efforts to adapt prison conditions to the court's ruling, and that postponing the execution date of the ruling by at least 8 years is unreasonable.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the noble personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam. After his demise and martyrdom, his enemies, who had seized the government, would insult him for many years at their podiums. They would insult him throughout that vast country. They would speak harshly of the commander of the faithful, who was the embodiment of piety, justice, and fair-mindedness. Coincidentally, when we take a general look at those events, we see in that prolonged battle, the commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, was the final victor. Today, notice Saul's name and personality stand in this vast human panorama. He stands at the peak, and there is no trace of his enemies. His Nahjul Balagha is an instructive lesson for heightened individuals. His tradition is the most important and prominent tradition after that of the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. His form of justice and his great personality were outstanding features in this day and age. His cause defeated that of his enemies. He was the final victor.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One criterion is that there were seemingly two conflicting sets of characteristics in the commander of the faithful. The first was steadfastness, resistance, and strictness. Another was leniency, compassion, and clemency. These qualities existed in the commander of the faithful to their perfection. He was steadfast and strict in the face of every evasive course of action. In the face of oppression, oppressors, deviation from the path of God, transgression, and greed, the commander of the faithful would stand up against these matters with complete steadfastness and power. His resistance against those conditions is unprecedented to this very day. He also behaved in a completely sensitive and delicate manner when it came to divine remembrance and dhikr. He behaved similarly towards the oppressed, underprivileged, and vulnerable classes of society. This great personality is the greatest martyr, not only in the history of Islam, but also throughout the history of humanity. There is an epithet that has been used for Hazrat Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, the master of martyrs, Thar Allah, which means someone whose blood is the money of God. This is what Thar Allah means. His blood is valuable, and the value of blood from such dear personalities is so heavy that only Allah the Exalted can repay them. The same epithet has been used for the commander of the faithful alayhi salam. You say in some prayers, "Greetings be upon you, Thar Allah, and you, son of him who is Thar Allah."
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.